Was the US midterm elections really a victory for the Democrats? Why is F2 the favorite function key for our politicians? What's wrong with the way the middle class imbibe values in their kids? All these bhari questions and your favorite what song contest in this episode of Attention Please podcast. Coming right up. Hi and welcome to episode 15 of Attention Please podcast on the Talking Stuff Network. We are recording this on Sunday, the 11th of November 2018. And owing to the magic of time travel, we have our host still enjoying his Saturday despite the wildfires around him. Hi Arnab, how's your weekend so far?
It's been good. It's been a rough week in my neighborhood. There's been a shooting, which is again par for the course in the US. We get used to it, like I guess pollution in India. It's just something which happens, and there's nothing really you can do about it, given in the US. Given, and we might do a show on that one day about America's fascination with guns and why it never seems to go away. This is something which the rest of the world just doesn't understand, why Americans are so wedded to their guns, despite the enormous cost that it incurs every year in terms of life lost for a society which is safety obsessed in every other respect, except when it comes to guns, which then becomes part of his blind spot. But again, that's a topic for another day. Well, thank you, everyone. Thank you, everyone, for joining. Thank you for staying with us for so many episodes. Just before we start again, I think I haven't done that last podcast, so I'll do it this time again, asking for your support on Patreon. So it's a page. We'll have the link in the podcast. For those of you who enjoy this podcast and want to see it persist, the best way to show your love is to make a monthly payment. And yes, this will dovetail later into the main topic for the day. So money is good. Again, we want to keep. Again, it's not that we hire anyone or there are salaries to be paid. So we're not like News Laundry in that respect. But what they say is actually true. That if you don't pay for the news or opinions, then somebody else is paying for it. We want to keep this place absolutely free from any commerce or any commercial considerations. And so we would request a monthly contribution for those of you who feel it appropriate. But again, there will be no paywall ever. So whatever you get for free, you'll also get for paid. But again, soliciting contributions for on Patreon. The link will be there. Before we go on, I just want to again stress that the purpose of this podcast is, and I've said this before, but sometimes it needs stressing, it needs repeating, perhaps for myself, that the reason why I have this is ultimately my goal is to have, and these are early days and very humble origins, but I want to have moving forward a platform for myself in this digital era where we've kind of moved beyond text. So people want video and audio. I think they want video more than anything else, but as I've discussed, I'm built for the age of video, so I'll just keep my face inside the shadows for now. So this is the purpose of this is to create a platform. I'm very disappointed with mainstream media and even social media, the more new age websites, because they mirror the political corruption that mainstream media is. So whatever website you subscribe to, everybody is politically slanted. There are virtually no centrist voices out there. That by mean centrist, I mean which evaluates issues based on their own merit and not because of the predominant opinion in the camp they wish to belong to. That is what I call centrist, where it doesn't mean that all opinions will be classified as centrist. I am definitely not centrist in many of my opinions. I lean to the right sometimes, I lean to the left sometimes, but the thing is, I lean based on issues, not based on considering myself as belonging to any ideological camp. And I think that over the years, we've been discussing that with the centrifuge effect, which I talked about in my last podcast, that with social media as it is and with the political climate, both in the US and both in India, that the central space has kind of become a vacuum, pushing people to the extremities, that the centrifugal force is too extreme. And while we may complain about that, there's always something which we can do about it. And so this podcast is my humble attempt to do something about it and to create a platform for not just for me, but for other centrist voices, even for other voices which are right-wing or left-wing. I hope moving forward to have guests which represent both opinions, and I hope that we'll be able to have a civilized debate, which is, again, difficult for somebody whose name is Arnab, but I hope to show that not all Arnabs are the same.
Yeah, you spoke about centrifuge effect. So I think the US elections was, like you tweeted, a perfect example of that. So let's get on to this actually happened.
So this actually happened. So the US, there was a huge event. Normally, nobody cares about the midterms. When I say nobody, last time when Obama was the president, nobody cared in the mainstream media, because mainstream media was by and large liberal and by and large aligned with Obama. But the conservative media, the conservative focus groups did not ignore it. And conservatives came out in huge numbers, and the Democrats lost both the House as well as the Senate. And that usually happens. So normally what happens is the House and the Senate usually is of the opposite opinion as the president. This is because the president usually a vote in the midterm is a vote against the president. And that's why the political parties are always of the opposite polarities. This has always been considered to be a good thing in American politics, because that means there's a series of checks and balances on the president. But it also leads to a lot of gridlock, a lot of legislative gridlock, because as in this case, when Obama was the president, the Republicans basically stalled everything. They wouldn't let anything go because it would make the president look bad. And with this election, the Democrats now control the House. They don't control the Senate. But they still have enough power now to bring DC to a gridlock, which I'm pretty sure they're absolutely going to do. Including perhaps, I don't know if, because I've heard it, I don't know if they have the legal right to do it, but also to subpoena Donald Trump's tax returns, which again, he has steadfastly refused to divulge for reasons that are not difficult to you know, understand why he wouldn't want his tax returns to be made public, because I believe, and a lot of people believe, that he's not as rich as he claims to be. I think that is the most important thing. And given the kind of person he is, given the pompous blowhard that he is, and we'll again talk about this, is a very good topic, this aura of success is so much important to be successful, that if we came to know what his actual net worth was, it would deflate him in a way that perhaps nothing that Donald Trump says could. I mean, he's basically shown himself to be Mr. Teflon himself. Nothing he does, whether it be sexual harassment or, you know, bullying the parents of someone who gave their life for the country, nothing brings him down. So this might, at least in his own eyes, this would definitely deflate him if his tax returns came out. But it's not really the topic for today. The topic for today is that the election outcome is very interesting in that sense that Democrats themselves, even after the elections, are disappointed. They won the House, they didn't win the Senate, but they're disappointed because it was not as overwhelming a mandate against Trump that they hoped it would be. It was fairly obvious, because it happens in the US, no matter how good or how bad the president is, that one of the houses, sometimes both, swings the other way. That's inevitable. And so the Democrats winning the House isn't that big a deal. It's the way they won it, which was not overwhelming, and the fact that they couldn't flip the Senate. And given that the narrative has been that Donald Trump is a disaster for the country, that he has been a disastrous president, it just goes to show that that's not really what the people think. And as Donald Trump, and of course in an unprecedented way, because virtually everything about Donald Trump is unprecedented, after the midterms, he actually went through the list of Republicans who lost and said, this guy lost because he didn't support me, because he didn't bow and kiss my ring, essentially. And he had a point. So again, normally what happens is when a president belongs to a political party, they don't usually call out the losers like that. But Trump isn't really a Republican, and that many Republicans have also realized that he's basically himself. The Republican Party is just an organism of which he's feeding off. So he is essentially like a virus, good or bad, I mean, or bacteria, let's say, because there's some good bacteria, some bad bacteria also. But he's basically feeding off the Republicans at this point of time. So he doesn't really care for the Republican Party or for Republicans per se. All he cares for is the personal loyalty that people have towards him. And this gave him, and he has a valid point, that Republicans who did not throw in their lot with him or did not, essentially, as I said, kiss his ring, lost badly. And those who didn't. I mean, so this is not definitely not a mandate against Trump as the Democratic-leaning liberal media would have liked it to have been. I don't think anybody is now saying that this is a verdict against Trump. And this should be worrying for the Democrats. Because contrast this with what happened when Obama was the president, when there was an absolute groundswell against him. Of course, it was then denigrated as being racist, white backlash, but whatever it is, there was a definite backlash. The Tea Party came into power, you know, the age of Ted Cruz and these Republicans, that's when it started. But with Democrats, that hasn't happened. Even with Democrats, if you look at the people who won on the Democrat side, it's the left liberal socialist wing of the party, which is gradually becoming more and more dominant, which brings me to, again, to the centrifuge effect, where both the right and the left are hardening. And Nancy Pelosi, who is possibly going to be the head of the Democrat, you know, the House at this point of time, the leader of the opposition per se in Indian terms, isn't actually aligned with either the extreme left or the extreme right. So she is kind of centrist, and I believe that she will be out of tune with the voice of the Democrat Party, which is going to be predominantly very, very combative. I think Trump has shown that you have to be combative in this day and age, that there is no place for compromise, there is no place for common ground. And the Democrats now, for I think in many years, have a batch which will be as Trumpian as Trump can be. But unfortunately, the Democrat Party, to their detriment, is still controlled by the centrists. And there is going to be, what is going to be interesting for those of you who like to watch US politics, is that it's not just going to be Democrats versus the Republicans, which is, you know, par for the course, but it's going to be Democrats versus themselves. Because there is an extreme left wing of the party, which is gradually on the ascendance, in the same way that the Tea Party were on the ascendant. And the Tea Party clashed with, if you remember, the Tea Party, the right wing of the party, clashed with the centrist Republicans. I think we're going to see something very similar. At least the Republicans had a more overwhelming, mandate. And the Democrats' mandate, if anything, is fairly weak. Moving on to the next topic. So right now we are in, I don't even know what, Vikram, what's called what in India anymore. So we're in the middle of a renaming frenzy. And if Shakespeare said, what's in a name? I think Mr. Ajay Mohan Bisht knows that everything is in a name. I really don't think that Mr. Ajay Mohan Bisht would have been what he is with that name. But he is Yogi Adityanath. And there's absolutely, this is a perfect name that somebody could choose. I mean, Aditya is a power word. And Adityanath puts, you know, you don't need to see him, but, you know, there's like man force kind of dripping out of that. It's a powerful name. And combined with Yogi Adityanath, that's like real, real power. It's the power stemming from religion. This is a great name, I would say, for a politician. And some people don't have great names, like Sambit Patra. And in Indian politics, name is everything. I mean, ask Rahul Gandhi. It's not his name. It's his last name, which is everything. So names matter a lot. You know, brands matter a lot. And what Mr. Yogi Adityanath is currently doing is something which, again, has been a persistent motive of the Hindu right, which is to systematically... It's not just a question of renaming. It's systematically taking out what is considered to be Islamic influence. Now, is that a good thing or is that a bad thing? Now, there is no doubt, and liberal historians try to, you know, play around this, that the legacy of Islam is one of colonialism. I remember there was, so Mr. Shashi Tharoor at the Calcutta Lit Meet, he was sitting in front of the Victoria Memorial, and he pointed to it and he said, this is a monument to, I mean, it's ironic that we're talking about British colonialism while sitting in the shadow of the biggest monument to British colonialism. And he asked a Trinamool Congress MP who was there that maybe we should collaborate and, you know, change this to a museum against colonialism, like the Holocaust Museum in DC. So that night there was this party at the Lit Meet, and I cornered Mr. Tharoor and I told him that this is a very dangerous argument to make, where you're trying to take a historic monument and turn and flip it. I thought that you guys were against this when it came to, you know, masjids, but you're basically saying the same thing over here. You just, and so Mr. Tharoor's counter to that was, because Muslims were not the same as the British. The Muslims stayed on, and the British went back. They never really assimilated with us. And I didn't, of course, argue, but I don't quite buy that. So the fact that the nature of the Islamic invasion was different from that of the Christian invasion doesn't delegitimize the fact that it was an invasion, that it was colonialism, that that there was overwhelming torture inflicted on the native population of Hindus, and that this was not good for the country. That in terms of bad colonialism, both were bad. The fact that, you know, one person had a base in England and the other person had a base in Afghanistan, which they didn't have, and so they had to kind of settle down in India, is just happenstance. I don't think that changes things. But when it comes to the core principle, should you alter history? For me, my opinion is no, you shouldn't, because of the moment you start doing it, whether it be British colonialism or Islamic colonialism, you have started looking back. No good can come from this. Now, I understand that there is a counter logic to this. A few years ago, there was in the US, there was this obscene, you know, maybe I should not use the word obscene, but I considered it obscene. Obscene was to take Civil War monuments and just take them down. Again, the logic was, yes, they were given was the Civil War monuments were a testament to America's racist heritage, and that just by being there, they were reminding or endorsing that racist heritage. Now, there is no doubt that it is there because of the racist heritage. There's no doubt. It doesn't, and many Republicans started saying, no, it's got nothing to do with racism. It's all about culture. No, it's not. It is about racism. The reason why they were constructed was essentially as triumphs to racism, in the same way that when temples were destroyed and mosques were constructed, it was. Let's not deny that. You know, infantilizing the discourse doesn't do anybody any good. Okay, let's be mature enough to understand why things happened, but be also mature enough to understand that this happened hundreds of years ago. Okay, this has got nothing to do with us at this point of time. And trying to rewind doesn't do anybody any good. It's good for getting votes. It's good for saying we're actually doing something. It's the simplest thing to do, is to take something, break it, make something on it when you are in power, or to just rename, which is even a path of lesser resistance. So it's not that these things cannot be done. You know, taking down monuments of the South. Again, somebody would say that those were the precise things which led to the Trump wave. We can't go back in history and see what would have happened. But if you don't, just don't. There was no reason to do it. Nothing good came of it. I mean, there are other ways of dealing with racism rather than taking down statues. But those are emotive things. Many people came out and said, this is South, is a part of my heritage. True. And why would you then? And this came out. This came out in the voting. This came out in the elections. So why would you want to do that? These things are essentially done for political gains in this day and age. It is not to solve a problem, because that problem cannot be solved. If we have a problem of communalism, that cannot be solved. If we have a problem of racism, that cannot be solved by taking down a few statues. There's just symbolism, and that's provocative symbolism on both sides. So for me, this whole thing of renaming, there's obviously the financial implications of, because they're documents, you just can't do a search replace on a Word file. It's not as simple as that. So there is, of course, the financial ramifications of serially renaming places. But there's also this attempt to push back history. And both liberals as well as conservatives in India, both the left and both the right, they're fine with this as long as it's for their side. So for me, I oppose in general. It's not just a question of renaming, but I find it counterproductive to try to roll back history. If there has been any historical hurts, if there is any legacy, negative legacy that carries on from history, there are. I'm not saying that we forget. I'm not even saying we forgive. There are ways of dealing with it, which are much more deep-rooted, in that sense, more difficult than just taking some place and just renaming it. I don't think it achieves anything except polarize people. And sometimes you might want to polarize people. You think it's a great thing, but things don't often come out the way you want them to. And I believe, at least in the American sense, that this decision to take down any kind of remnants of the South didn't really pan out well for liberals in any way. Again, we'll never know. But did you get the base on your side? Perhaps you did for some time, but you also led to the other side pulling rank, making them feel as if their heritage was under threat. And once you get people to feel that they're under threat, that's when they go feel motivated enough to vote. And all of us know that. Now, from a political strategy point of view, you would want to do it to your side, right? But why would you want to do it to the other side? That's the problem with when you rename. When you rename Allahabad to Prayag, you think you're consolidating the Hindu vote, but you actually might be consolidating the party which is going to vote against you by doing this. Because this is a very direct, when you take, and you can say, oh, the name was Prayag, it is still the Prayag. I'm not even getting into the historical, this is like getting into the Tipu Sultan debate. Was Tipu Sultan good? Was Tipu Sultan bad? It's not important, okay? Like any ruler, Tipu Sultan was strategically good and strategically bad. That's the reality.
Right.
So historians always try to say, oh, Tipu Sultan was a great king. No, he wasn't. He was a king. Kings do shit stuff all the time, okay? That's all rulers do. And was his personal belief, he was a very secular person. That's like saying Jawaharlal Nehru firmly believed in freedom of press. Or maybe he believed in freedom of press. I don't know. But he didn't act like it all the time. So I don't really care whether the guy was liberal, whether the guy was secular. We have to look at what he did. And it doesn't do anybody good to deny what he did. So again, was Tipu Sultan bad? Was Tipu Sultan good? Honestly, both. But that doesn't mean that we should be voting today based on what Tipu Sultan was. It doesn't do anybody good, but that's what it's become. For the Congress, celebrating Tipu Sultan is a way of essentially minority appeasement. And for the right parties, dissing Tipu Sultan is exactly the opposite of that. For me, Tipu Sultan isn't an issue at all. Tipu Sultan should not be an issue. Just like whether the city is Allahabad or Prayag should not be an issue in this day and age when we have so many other problems. But politicians always gravitate to these things because they are very visible, they're very emotional, and they don't need to really do anything except issue a farman which says so-and-so is henceforth shall now be called so-and-so.
I know we spoke about this a little bit in the pre-show banter, but again, if we talk about it purely from a branding point of view, right? Like I said, bringing in another example, I mean, KFC, when it was Kentucky Fried Chicken, they rebranded themselves to KFC because there was some negative from their marketing guys. They said, fried is not a good word to have because, people want to get healthier. And if you want to move to a kind of vegetarian market like India, again, chicken, they didn't want it in part of the name. So they moved it to KFC.
Yes. By the way, before that, they had another name. It was called Kitchen Fresh Chicken, by the way.
I didn't know that. Okay.
Yes. So... Yeah, so there was another step before that, the Kitchen Fresh Chicken. And then they basically said, we don't stand for anything. It's just three alphabets, KFC.
KFC.
Go on. What?
Yesterday or day before, I saw in the news that again, I think BJP has taken this renaming as one of the major poll points, because somebody in Hyderabad BJP, they have promised that if they come to power in Telangana, they're going to rename Hyderabad. Now, I mean, as a staunch Hyderabadi, I'm not going to let my emotions come into this, though I have a lot to say about it. But purely from a branding point, like I said, why would you want to mess with a brand that's at least reasonably successful, right? When moving from Hyderabad to Bhagyanagar, that's what they've promised, by the way.
Yeah, so again, we can see that the whole thing is to essentially de-Islamicize, in a way, pretty much everything, and to kind of roll back and say, you know what, let's pretend as if they didn't exist. Unfortunately, you can't do that in history. They do exist. They are here.
You don't have a control.
The culture that we have, the culture, the food, everything. You know, that is what assimilation is. That is what history brings us. It doesn't necessarily, yes, they did bad things. Yes, they broke temples. Let's accept that. Yes, the British Christians, they took from us. They raided us. They destroyed us. But they, and this was not because they were, as Manmohan Singh's, Dr. Manmohan Singh said, they were good people. No, it's not because they were good people that they created the railways. They did it because it helped them in their exploitation. But they also did it. That it doesn't. That's the thing about history. You know, sometimes, and this is a line which was in Yathrik, which was, in sometimes good things happen because of the bad. And when the bad things happen, we don't think that. But sometimes the good things come out of bad. And good things have come out of both Islamic imperialism and Christian imperialism. Good things have happened. They have enriched our culture. The fact that I'm talking right now in English is a remnant of colonialism. I'm not going to deny it, that this is a remnant of British colonialism. But that doesn't mean that I'll start talking in Bengali, or that doesn't mean that. I prefer talking in English. That doesn't mean that I'm not proud of Bengali. But it's just that I'm more comfortable in English. And that's just a fact of life. Now, if it hadn't been the British, if it had been the French, or if I was born in Chandannagar or Pondicherry, I'd be fluent in French. That doesn't deny the fact that the French were imperialists. Or that doesn't mean that I should consciously decide at this point of time not to talk in English or in French. Because then I would be screwing myself. So this is really the point. It's more than a brand name. I think brand names can be changed. I mean, who cares? But the fact is, it doesn't work also. I mean, KFC is still KFC. I mean, the chicken is really terrible. So and it is basically a heart attack in a box. So, but for me, this, I can totally understand this being an election issue, as I was just saying, that this is very easy to do, as creating a mandir isn't that easy to do, because the courts are involved. There's a lot of other things that need to happen, but renaming is just, it's very, very low hanging fruit. And I'm just worried that a lot of these renamings are going to happen, that they're not going to accomplish anything. They have nothing to do with development. They have nothing to do with anything good. They can't even roll back history, by the way. So how would renaming Hyderabad change to what did you say the name was going to be?
Bhagyanagar.
Bhagyanagar. How is it going to change anything about Hyderabad in terms of its culture, in terms of its, yes, its Islamic heritage? You can't get rid of that. By making it into Bhagyanagar, it's going to cause heartburn. That's all it's going to do. And I'm not talking about the heartburn that happens at the end of a Hyderabadi biryani. That's another kind of heartburn. But that's so even when Calcutta, there was a big thing, you know, Calcutta got renamed to Kolkata a long time ago. This was again, even for the liberal communist Bengalis, this was a cause celebre to, you know, to take, you know, to purge ourselves of the British influence of Calcutta. But the British made Calcutta. It was a guy called Job Charnock. There were three villages. He put them together. It was a British base. It became the British capital. And they called it Calcutta. The Bengali of it was Kolkata. So to take it out, to take Calcutta out, and this was again, I think, done by the communists, by the way, just right. So that you show that, you know, that the communists are no better in terms to playing the chauvinistic cards. So they actually did that. This, to me, made absolutely no sense. A city which is absolutely steeped in British colonial culture. I mean, there is nothing in Calcutta. In the most beautiful parts of Calcutta, unfortunately, happen to be of British vintage. Everything that's come after it, like the fake Tower of London that Mamata Banerjee constructed, is a monstrosity.
So that is the charm of Calcutta. Calcutta is, you know, it has this old world British charm around it. And are we going to try to deny it? We can't. That's one of the good things about history. It's not that, again, the Victoria Memorial is a lovely monument. And it is a monument to Victoria. Just putting us, you know, making it into a Holocaust-like museum, you know, true, it kind of desecrates what it is, but it's not a monument to colonialism, as Dr. Tharoor put it. It just happens to be in the name of Queen Victoria. Inside it, there is, by the way, Tipu Sultan's sword, Hyder Ali's sword inside. So what are you going to call it? Is that Hyder Ali, Tipu Sultan, is it a memorial to Islamic imperialism? Let's not even ask those questions. And let's take all of it as history in a beautiful building. For me, that's it. That's the only truth.
Let's do the what song before we go on to the feature story. We didn't have a what song last week. And I guess a lot of people wrote in asking for a what song. So there's this song for this week. Should I drop in a quick clue?
Firstly, I think this is this. Everybody should get it. But this song has a sequence copied from Hot Shot Part 2.
That's the exact clue I had in mind too.
Is that a hint? I don't know. But here's the thing. I love this. I love this movie. This movie is pure 90s cheesy classic, and I love the songs. So, you know, this is a sentimental favorite of mine.
Okay, and here's the song. होने लगी है महफिल जवां कुछ कह रही है दिल की जुबां. And if you recognize the song, please do write in to us at appodcast@talkingstuff.net or tweet in to us. So all the best. Pehchano is gaane ko. And let's move on to the feature story, Arnab. Over to you.
Yes. So a few days ago, I had made a Facebook post on the curse of a middle-class upbringing. And for some strange reason, this got an enormous amount of engagement. I had just thrown it out there. And so it was surprisingly that there were so many people chose to engage with it. And I thought maybe I should talk about this a little bit more for those of you who didn't read. So essentially what I said in that kind of little snippet, nowadays, sometimes when it's something which is small, I don't write it in the blog. I just, write it in Facebook as a status update, take a screenshot and put it on Twitter. So I've been thinking, and again, one of the things which my parents love to tell me that I do is I blame my parents for everything. And I think this is a fairly natural proclivity for people to blame pretty much everything that's wrong in their life on their parents. I'm pretty sure my daughter will do the same. But for me, one of the things, so I try to be a little careful now that I'm a father myself to blame everything on my parents, which I was much more, much more comfortable doing, 5 years before. But now I'm a little bit hesitant because I'm a parent myself. But one of the things, and it's not generally, shouldn't be taken as a criticism of my parents as such, specifically, but one of the curses of being brought up middle class is that you imbibe a set of values, I feel, that kind of bind you to becoming middle class yourself. So there is this book or the series of things called Rich Dad, Poor Dad, whose basic thing is that the rich dad basically, tells his children the real secrets of becoming rich, and the poor dad never does, because the poor dad, whatever he teaches, basically allows, it leads people to make choices that keep them poor. It's not really the government or history or society that's making people rich or poor, but it's their upbringing itself, the life lessons they imbibe. Sometimes, not that anybody's actually telling you to do these things, but children learn best not when they're told, but when they see something. That's when children, and you know that, and I see that with my daughter. It is not necessarily what I tell her to do, but what she observes us doing. That's what she learns. I think one of the wrong things, and when I say wrong, I don't really mean wrong, but I'm struggling for the proper English word for it, is that there's this assumption that, if you work hard, and you work hard in a very academic way, and your success is measured through the metric of grades or you know, whether you got 100 out of 100 in mathematics, that somehow that there is an absolute correlation between working hard, being a diligent worker, and being honest to attaining success. There is a Bengali word which says, there's a Bengali phrase which goes, "Lekha pora gore koreje gari ghora choreje," which means who studies ultimately gets to ride a car. So this is, of course, in those days when riding a car was considered to be the pinnacle of success. Perhaps not so much today, but this was when we were growing up. So and I don't know if this is true for you, Vikram, so please feel free to chime in over here. But did you feel that when you were growing up, this was the kind of thing that you imbibed? I'm not saying people actually told you, but this thing that, you know, you have to be very honest and that you have to work hard and you have to work hard academically in order to succeed. Is that something which you also felt while growing up?
Absolutely. And I think you made the point about risk taking. Risk taking was seen as a vice, right? You don't take risks. You always play safe.
Yes. So I'm coming to that's the thing. It kind of comes into this cocoon of taking risks, because lying is also taking a risk. When you lie, you are taking a risk. I mean, when somebody says I'm honest, it's not essentially, I'm not saying that honest people are not good, but sometimes when somebody says that I'm honest, it's not necessarily because he's inherently good. It could be, and most of the time it is, that he's actually afraid to tell a lie. He's afraid of being found out. If the circumstances were such that there was no risk, I'm not absolutely sure that guy would stay honest.
Interesting. Yeah.
But in the middle class upbringing, we are kind of told that, you know, lying is a risk. That once people realize that you are like the little shepherd boy who cried wolf, and that nobody will come you when the wolves come and eat you up alive. Right? The story is a cautionary tale of people who lie and what terrible things happen to them. And as I've grown up, I've realized that's absolutely bull. Telling a lie is just another aspect of taking a risk. It's like, would you invest in bonds? Would you keep your money in a bank? Or would you invest in stocks? So lying is a risk. I remember there was a time in which I was sitting in a panel with another author. And what usually happens is that publishers never divulge actual sales figures. They're very, very cautious about doing it. Now, once one of my publishers they make errors, they send this whole Excel sheet of sales to, I guess, all authors, or at least they sent it to me. So I had the glorious privilege of looking at the actual sales numbers of some of our most successful authors. Now, this same person, who obviously didn't know that I had senior sales, in a public forum, like straight up, started fabricating. I'm not talking about a little delta here and there. I'm talking about freaking putting extra zeros at the end.
Wow.
Of what his actual sales were. And for me, I was like, first of all, I was aghast. But then I admired the fact. And with Donald Trump as a president, you know, that's why I've said saying this. You see where lying gets you. You know, his whole thing, you know, he's been a confidence trickster his whole life. And this is where it gets you to becoming the most powerful man in the world. He's lied about everything with a straight face. He even lies. I mean, there's a caravan coming. If you notice, the caravan's gone away now. Now that the midterms are over, everybody's noticed that there is no caravan coming. There's no army of zombies. He sent like a military to the southern border as if there were actually an invading force coming. They've all gone away now that the midterms are gone. And even their sympathetic media, Fox News, they're not even talking about it, because everybody knew that there is no caravan.
Facts don't matter.
So it's a lie. Facts don't matter. It's a lie. And the fact that Trump can lie, I mean, all politicians lie. But the fact that Trump can take the lying to a place where nobody has. Even Bill Clinton was very notorious for lying. But even Bill Clinton had his lines. And Trump has basically erased the lines. And guess what? Guess what's the difference between Bill Clinton and Trump? Bill Clinton had middle class parents and Trump didn't. So Obama did have middle class parents. So this is not just an Indian thing. It's common to pretty much, I think, parents across the world that they teach their children the fact that hard work and that you shouldn't lie. And I don't want to tell my so it's very important, especially in this day and age of Instagram, of social media, that success, if you say that you're successful 100, to kind of in a Goebbelian way, if you say I'm successful 10 times, people think you are successful. I remember there was this book event where this was for Yatrik, I remember. And the conversation was going on. This was when Yatrik was being released. And I said, I sometimes feel that the mind could have been better written. I read sections of it and I cringe. I feel, man, I really wrote this portion badly. I wish I had another chance to go back and rewrite it. So after the event was over, there was a gentleman who was sitting there. He just came up to me and said, why did you have to say all those things? I mean, you never say those things in an event. There are media people watching it. And that's the impression that everybody got out of it, that, you write shitty books. There's no reason for you to say it. Even if you feel it, keep it to yourself. Okay, you don't say this in this kind of way. Nobody appreciates your honesty. I do. I found it refreshing that you came out and said this, and not a lot of authors would say this. But there was no need to say this. And again, I kind of, things like this have been told to me a lot, many times, that I put out my failures. Personally, I put out, but for me, it's very important that I be honest. And again, this is not stemming from the goodness of my heart so much as fear. I kind of believe that there is some kind of, the last thing that I want anybody to think of me is that I lie. Again, it's not a question of, and as written in the post, it's not that I haven't taken like, 7 sachets of ketchup from Taco Bell. Not that kind of honesty. I'm not talking about that, but I'm talking about the major things. I will never overstate my sales numbers. I will never pretend to be something I'm not. Those things are inherent to me. And I see over the years, I've seen that a lot of successful people are people who are essentially liars. And they do lie. They lie strategically. It's not that they're just that they're pathological liars, that they just can't control lies, but they lie specifically. It's like Adam Gilchrist and his, Adam Gilchrist used to walk, except that one time exactly. He didn't. And then, but his reputation was that he never walked. He always walks. So of course, he had a heads up on. I mean, he managed to stay on. So that, the strategic. The strategic dishonesty is something which I believe that, and I don't know. I mean, I struggle nowadays because I'm trying to teach my daughter the same things that my parents taught me. That you study hard, you read more than the other kids, you be honest, and that somehow all of this will create enough good karma for you to go and become successful. And somehow I'm not convinced that that is the way. I'm not going to tell her to be dishonest. I'm struggling with what exactly to tell her, by the way. But I also feel that what happens is that then when you become older and you see that the world doesn't really work like this, you kind of become more cynical. You kind of think and you take your honesty and put it as a medal also. And my God, I'm honest and look at what the world did to me. But it's not that you were honest and the world did this to you. It's just the world is like that. And that you cannot expect that just because you do good things, that it naturally correlates to good things happening to you. I think that's a fundamental assumption that we have. That's why we pray to God. Because we believe that if we pray to God, if we do good things, then good things will happen to us. That goodness begets goodness. I can't say that's true. What matters in life is luck. There's no two ways about it. Most of the successful people that I have seen have just been at the right place at the right time. But they've also brought some of the other things into it. One of the things that I believe is so very important in today's life, and I regret not having done it myself when I was younger, was put a greater emphasis on how I looked. I mean, this is not a sly at Dhruvrati, okay? Okay, it's a sly at Dhruvrati. But
there's that honesty coming through again. You shouldn't have said that.
There's honesty coming through. Yeah, so no, but I'm just saying that again, that was Amitra, I was trying to be humorous there. But the point is, I've seen time and time again that even in academia, it's the person who presents himself well. And I'm talking about not just a, you know, having a good PowerPoint presentation, but somebody who looks the part, somebody who looks competent. And it just happens to be that being overweight, you don't look competent. You look like you are a careless bear. Okay, it just doesn't, and even you can, you know, social justice it around and say diversity, you know, we shouldn't judge people by their looks and everything, but it's just not the way the world works, unfortunately. People do judge you on the looks. It doesn't matter if they're liberal or conservative, they just do. Whether they state it or not, they just do. And I've seen that happen. I've seen that in the same situation, good-looking men, and I'm comparing myself to men, good-looking men have just happened to have done better. They've made an impression, and I'm not holding it against them. I'm saying that rather than focusing purely on academic outcomes, it's time that middle-class parents taught their children that it's also important to present yourself well. Maybe I can't teach my children to lie, but I also have to teach them that honesty is, again, it's not a badge that you carry around with you to feel good. And that just because you're being honest doesn't necessarily mean that good things will happen to you. Honesty is just a risk mitigation measure. That's all.
That's a phenomenal way to put it. Yeah. It's a cost-benefit analysis.
It's just it. Yes, it's just a risk mitigator. There's no moral weight behind it. The problem happens when you feel that there's a moral weight behind it. You look back and you say, I took the moral decision. And why did the world F me over? That's where regret comes from. And I'm saying this as somebody who has suffered through this. I'm not saying this is a kind of a scientist looking dispassionately at the world and saying, well, this happens. No, I'm saying this from my own perspective. I have done this kind of retroactive looking back at my life and saying, you know, why didn't I do this? Maybe I should have lied about my sales figures. Maybe I should have hired a pub PR. Maybe I should have just bought my own book. Maybe I should have. Who knows what would have happened? But it just, that part that, you know, I had to take, it was suggested to me. I'm not saying that the thought never came across my mind that maybe I should do this. But I just felt that that was not the way to getting where I wanted to be. This is where that whole middle class moral weight comes back in. This is an absolute creation of the mind. I now realize that. Not that I have grown beyond it. If I ever have a chance, I don't want to do the whole PR thing, you know, get positive press by essentially paying for it. But again, people will say, what's wrong in it? And I don't think there's anything wrong in it, but there's a part of me which says there's something wrong in it, and that's because of my middle-class upbringing. So I've talked to people, and many people feel this from different perspectives, and not everybody's perspective is of mine, because I've tried to, you know, be someone in the creative space, the people who, you know, whose entire experience has been in the corporate world. And many people feel that they're hampered by that middle-class upbringing, that this underlying assumption that the meritorious win, and that those who are not meritorious will ultimately get winnowed out. They might win a battle, but they will lose the war. That doesn't really happen. They will win enough battles for you to drop out of the war. And if they lose at that point of time, you're not looking at it because you're dead. So I don't know. I struggle with this all the time, as to what kind of values do I inculcate in my daughter in this day and age, where showbazi has become so much a part of who we are. Everybody is their personal brand with social media, I get to hear. And what do brands do? Are they always honest? No, they aren't. So maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm a dinosaur. Maybe, and you know, you can tell me, Vikram, you know, what you think about this. But I think it's fundamentally time, and I don't think I have the answers. Maybe I'll come to the answer, but it's fundamentally time that we kind of tell our children that the success that you see in people is because of the amount of risk they took. It's the two things, luck and risk. So the people who are successful are people who took risks that you didn't take. And it's perfectly fine not to take those risks. Everybody has a risk appetite. But everything that we do in life has to be seen through the prism of risk and luck. It just like corporations do, in a way. It cannot be seen through the prism of what's right and what's wrong. Because the conception of right or wrong is something which could effectively be mine and mine only. The world doesn't need to subscribe to that notion of right and wrong. And somehow I think some of our frustrations come because we feel that the world owes us something because we are being honest. Because there is a good begets good. And that's absolutely wrong, that there is nothing like that actually in reality.
But Arnab, I mean, one thing you've kept out of the equation here, and I'm putting air quotes here, is the afterlife reward, right? I mean, that's a carrot which is dangled by parents to fearful kids, saying, okay, you might not really make, you know, if you're good, that's how you get into heaven, or that's how you get punyam points, or however it works.
Well, for me, it's never been, please, that's not something which my parents told me. I think my parents were sufficiently, at least my dad was sufficiently atheist to not say that, you know, I will get my, you know, Ben, you know, I'll get my rewards in the next life. But for me, that doesn't matter. If I can't remember what, if, again, this, there is, so I read this book. Hold on, let me just Google this, because I don't remember. So I don't want to give the wrong name, but it was about, it was a fascinating book. Agora at the Left Hand of God. Have you read it?
Never heard of it. Sorry.
So Agora at the Left Hand of God, which, by the way, was recommended to me by an university professor. It was a fascinating guy I knew once. So it's about tantric practice. So it has some amazing insights into tantric practice. And one of the things is, of course, rebirth. And it is a very, very interesting take, since you talked about, you know, heaven and hell and being born again. It had this, among many things, some of it are mind-bending, some of it are frankly ridiculous, and some of it like makes you look and think of things in a different way, was that we get born, you know, of course there's rebirth, and while we don't really remember what we were in the previous life, but the skills we acquired carry on. So when you see that somebody is very good at maths and you are not, or that somebody can master an instrument at a very young age, it's not that the guy picked it up when you did. He picked it up in a previous birth and he's just carrying it over. That the whole notion of somebody being much better at you than anything, of why Sachin Tendulkar or why Virat Kohli. Well, guess what? Sachin Tendulkar was perhaps Sujit Somasundar in a previous life. And, you know, he's over his different lifetimes, he's just consistently acquired. So the problem is, according to the book, is that we are born so many times that we always diversify. We never pursue. And that's where the luck comes in. If you pursue in a number of successive births the same skill, that's when you start getting the payoff. So I guess, in a way, when my dad is, or when my middle class upbringing is telling me to say, you know, excel in maths, I think the main thing is that most parents are asking their kids to excel in maths. So that is going to be the skill that you will be judged on in this life, next life. So do your maths, but next life, or perhaps life after that, you will be Ramanujan. Maybe, I don't know. But if you want to learn guitar or rollerblading, maybe the opportunity for you having another life in which your parents also ask you to learn rollerblading is very low. I don't know. This might explain why middle class parents tell us to do maths, because of the community pressure to do maths. It's the likelihood that in the next janam you will also be doing maths is higher. Maybe that's from now on it will be computer programming. You know, learn C language. So next time you go there, you'll you're in, you know, next birth, you're a god in PHP. I don't know what it is. But this is, since you brought up, you know, birth and rebirth, I thought I would bring it up. It's a little facetious here, but maybe worth considering why we do the things that we end up doing in life. So again, one of the theses of the book was that many of the choices that you believe you're taking just now have already been pre-coded for you births back. So you're kind of going to make that choice in any ways because of the person you are, not in one birth, but across multiple births. And that death is just a door. It's just a door from moving to one room to another. Very interesting book. I know that recommend that those of you who haven't read it, who have some interest in spirituality, read it. I'm not a spiritual person, but I'm very interested in spirituality. Yes. As I'm getting older, I'm getting more and more interested in spirituality. Because as I approach death, I'm more concerned about, you know, things of that sort. While when I was 20, I was more concerned about Tip Tip Barsa Pani. But I'm, you know, again, that phase of my life is over for good. And I'm moving on to other things. So with that, let's conclude for today. I'm hoping to hear your thoughts on this very, very important. I think this touches a chord with everyone, regardless of whether you like Modi or not. I think all of us have something to say about success and failure. Oh, by the way, before I conclude, there was something which I read and people said that if you redefine your success as being honest and good, then you're always successful. Please spare me. Please. Okay. So please, no. There is no... Everybody wants tangible rewards. They
in this life.
Whatever they have done. In this life, I want tangible rewards. I want some of my goals to be met. The path of walking that goal is not the goal. Okay. No, it's not. Please leave that for somebody else. I'm not buying this. If you feel that, well, you're a better person than I am. But no, I've never felt that way. I've never felt that the means are the ends. No, they never are. And I'm pretty sure that the really successful people in life, and we all know what I mean by successful, will never honestly tell you that. I mean, they might tell you in a TEDx talk exactly that. But if you really ask them when they're three drinks down, they will absolutely deny that being true. Okay, that is my last thought for today.
Okay, that was our podcast for today. And you can listen to it on talkingstuff.net/APP. And you can head over to the link I just mentioned, talkingstuff.net/APP. And we also have a subscribe tab, which will help you with links to download the right podcast apps for your phone. And also help with subscribing it so that you can always have the latest Arnab on your phone on Sunday evenings or Sunday mornings, depending on where you are. We'll also have links to the book Arnab mentioned. And you also have a link to the Patreon page in the same link. So let me again repeat it. It's talkingstuff.net/APP. And you can find us on YouTube also, youtube.com/talkingstuffnet or Facebook at facebook.com/talkingstuffnet. Twitter is, no surprise here, talking stuff net. And of course, I'm available on Twitter at the Vikram Mohan. So Arnab, it was a different episode, I have to say. So please do send in your feedback. You can send it to Arnab or you can send it to us over at appodcast@talkingstuff.net. And of course, we share all your feedback with Arnab. And Arnab, we've got quite a bit of mail piling in. So maybe next week we should have answer some of the mails that you've got. So do send in your mails and, you know, we'll have a Q&A session with Arnab one of these upcoming episodes. So.
Yes, my birthday is coming up in December. So I was any case planning to do my year-end birthday episode again, questions and and comments episode. So we will definitely do that again before we conclude for today. My blog is greatbong.net and my Twitter is @greatbong. So please send in your bouquets and brickbats, as they like to say.
Bouquets for now.
More bouquets, please.
Yeah. Okay, thanks and goodbye.